Okay, now it's starting. Robert Stark here, joined here today with Matt Forney. Hey, Matt.
Thanks for having me on again, Rob. It's nice to be doing this with you yet again.
So, we're going to be discussing Jonathan Bowden. And I'll comment a little bit on Jonathan Bowden myself. One of my greatest regrets is that I never got the chance to interview him. I was going to interview him, and I have an interesting story. I sent an interview request to him, and then he died basically right after I sent that request, which was kind of a bizarre coincidence. But that is a major regret of mine that I never got a chance to interview him.
Oh, that's sorry to hear that. Before we go any further, I just want to mention that honestly, I'm not that familiar with Jonathan Bowden. I mean, I know his name. I've read some of his writings, but these two books that you wanted me to talk about that I reviewed recently, I read them primarily because Chip Smith, the head of Nine Bandit Books, which published both Bowden's books, sent them to me to reviews. Like, so I'm not as familiar with Bowden as I should be, aside from these two specific books.
And with these books, these were the first books that were published, and he became famous later on, more for, I'd say, his role in the movement called the European New Right. But these were his first books he published when he was he published these books when he was still in his 20s, so they came out around, I think, 89 or 90.
Actually, I forget specifically when Save Sack was published, but Mad, his first book, he actually published that and wrote it when he was only 18, even younger than that.
So is the writing style, would you say it sounds like something that a teenager might have written?
Mad, definitely. It's basically, the book is basically a book-length rant about everything. It has a certain structure. I mean, it's not just, you know, boom, just going maniacally about on everything and everything, but it's written in a sort of choppy sort of ranty writing style, a very kind of self-important. It's a good book, just to be to everyone's liking, and it definitely shows that he wrote it at a very young age. He wrote it as a teenager.
So, what kind of people what types would it appeal to the most?
I'd say it appealed to two different classes of people. It would appeal, number one, to self-important teenagers. People who have just started reading Nietzsche and are getting seriously into that sort of, you know, philosophy. Ayn Rand, Max Stirner, the philosophy of egoism and whatnot. There are people who would actually take it kind of seriously. But if you're a bit older, I'd recommend Mad, not so much as a straight philosophical treatise, but as a sort of, you know, a literary on its own. I mean, for all of the peccadilloes that Bowden shows in the work, it has a certain literary value. It's just don't take it too seriously, but enjoy it for what it is. It's an odd sort of literary work that sort of gives a hint at where Bowden would be going in the future.
So, give sort of a basic introduction to the main character. Is the character himself, or is it another character?
The main character really isn't that well defined. I mean, we're led to believe that sort of Bowden himself. It's just, but it's never really specified of a traditional narrative structure. It's basically just a character monologuing about
written for first person.
Monologuing about society and how society is sick. He eventually transitions into talking about sex and relationships with women, and then in the final third of the book, it all up. There's no continuous chapter headings, or whatever. It just sort of flows in this sort of continuous. I compared it to sort of like in a sort of musical fashion. It sort of just flows from one section to the other without really stopping, slowly transitioning from theme to theme.
So he is the character. He's confronted with the sort of the ghosts of a number of different historical figures.
Yes, pretty much. It's somewhat difficult to get into, at least initially, because, as I said, Bowden writes in a very distinctive sort of ranty prose style with paragraphs and run-on sentences going on for long, long periods of time. And he also uses a whole bunch of neologisms. For example, whenever he writes in order, instead of separating the two words, he combines them together. So it sort of works to get you into his state of mind at the particular moment. It's a book written out of, in many ways, anger and a sort of longing for a more traditional world, I would say.
You're saying sort of the theme of the sort of the emptiness of a modern life.
Yes, second half, which concerns sex. Probably one of the more memorable quotes in the book that he describes, mark a spirit of the divine, which is sort of something we can also understand because, here, we human beings are sexual beings, obviously, with sexual impulses. I mean, Robert, I know you're familiar with, Andy Nowicki and his novel. He sort of describes this duality of sex in his novel, similar fashion, where it's like, we have these impulses, yet at the same time we feel conflicted and guilty about them. Bowden confronts it in a more direct and, should I say, slightly immature, but still, wise fashion.
Would you say he's less moralistic than Andy Nowicki?
I'd say less moralistic, yeah. The book is written from the perspective of a man who's still trying to find his voice, find his identity. He talks more than he thinks, and he tends to operate on impulse more than thinking things out clearly. So, the work seems a bit disjointed in places from this perspective.
And you also say there's parallels to a teenage Rush. I mean, I'm relatively familiar with Rush, but not so much about his teenage years. Can you explain that?
Well, Rush has written in the past about how basically his motivation to become, a writer and become good with women comes from the fact that when he was a teenager, he was kind of a loser. I mean, he admits this in his books. Bowden is writing from the, I don't know much about Bowden, but, he is writing has that sort of, alienated edge to it. He's a guy who is, you know, sort of, maybe was kind of dorky, feels somewhat alienated from the world, feels somewhat, rejected from tradition, from, modern society. So he writes from a perspective, So he writes from the perspective of someone who observes the world and understands it keenly, but is not of it, and feels somewhat some resentment because of it. Now, I'm not like saying this is a bad thing or whatever; it is what it is.
And I've met Bowden, and I would say my impression of him is he's a very charismatic speaker. But then after he's done speaking, he is another side of him that I would say is that he actually comes across as more introverted, which is not something you would expect from someone who has a lot of charisma as a public speaker.
Well, the implication there, like I said, I don't know that much about Bowden, but the implication is that when he became an adult, when he was a young man, Bowden sort of trained himself to become more charismatic in this fashion. You know, to put it certainly, he was a late bloomer. Matt is written from the perspective of before this transition, when he was still more or less awkward and somewhat alien from the world.
So what is the significance of the historical figures that visit him?
He believes that these historical figures represent certain epochs of history and certain pinnacles of Western society, Western achievement. One of the figures I believe he talks about in the book is the Marquis de Sade. He went into Sade in a bit greater detail in his book, the book following this, but he regards Sade as sort of the id of the enlightenment, the embodiment of the enlightenment, the animalistic impulses that were unleashed by the rejection of God, the rejection of superstition and religion and Christianity in favor of quote-unquote logic and reason that was sort of that was unleashed by, say, the French Revolution, where the peasantry just rose up and viciously murdered the country's noble classes and the king and anyone thought was wealthier and privileged than they were. Like, Sade represents to the negative side of the Enlightenment. When you take the when you free the average man from the bounds of religion or superstition, he's going to act on his impulses. He's going to, lacking a moral code, he's just going to do whatever. And Sade was the embodiment of that. His entire life was dedicated to sexual pleasure, free from morality, free from whatever sort of moral codes that society might inflict on. So he did terrible things to women. He wrote in his writings, he talked about doing terrible things. And Bowden's saying, this was part of the natural progression of destroying God, of killing God, as Nietzsche might put it, and killing traditional morality. Like, you can't say destroy these structures and expect everyone to continue to behave under the same precepts that those structures created. You're going to get anarchy, or at the very least, moral relativism and just general chaos.
So, but he is saying that Assad represents a side of human nature, instead of saying that he's someone kind of weird or bizarre who's an anomaly.
Yes, pretty much. The Marquis de Sade is a far more significant... Bowden's belief is that this Marquis de Sade is a far more significant historical figure than we believe than most of you was. The Marquis de Sade was more or less pretty much ignored up until about 50 years ago, when postmodern French philosophers such as Simone de Beauvoir started resurrecting him and trying to sanitize him for the benefit of their audiences. And again, Bowden confronts this more directly in his companion volume to Mad. Basically, he argued that the French philosophers sort of had it right in acknowledging Sade as being important, as opposed to the English-American tradition that entirely ignored him or dismissed him as a vile merit. He accused the Continentalists of sanitizing Sade, of trying to make him safe for their upper-class audiences. And he's saying, you know, you can't whitewash a guy like Sade. He's important.
And would you say Sade would be his behavior and writings would be shocking by today's standards?
I'd say they still be, even though we supposedly live in an era of moral degeneracy. I mean, I'm not the person to make this argument, but in many ways we're still being governed by Christian morals and ethics, only without Christianity. Modern leftism is in many ways a sort of secular version of Christianity, with Christian, with kind of morals, you know, laws running, you know, you get the feminist obsession with rape and rape culture and the ways to be an ethical slut, and which is sort of like being a super alcoholic. And you get all these, and Sade stood for the destruction of all these rules, even the rules that the left wants to impose on us. He wanted to. His philosophy was that of an existence entirely without morality or the sort of laws that he believed were about imposing control over people.
So are there? What would be a good modern day parallel to Sade?
I honest to God can't really think of one. The closest I could come would be the culture of, and again, this is a far sort of stretch, the culture of the manosphere, or at the very least sort of the whole idea of rejecting both traditional Christian mores, which are more or less useless if you're trying to, as a man in this society, as well as the new left-wing mores of ethical sluttiness strict laws of governing consent, and this is how you can act, and political correctness. Like I said, this is a very sort of far-fetched comparison, but in many ways, it sort of fulfills that sort of analogous. It's sort of analogous to the way Sade did things, because on one hand, Sade opposed. He opposed the traditional morality of Bourbon France, but he also was not a big fan of the Enlightenment, as the post Enlightenment as well. And he sort of tried to get along with them, but it was the revolutionary France that eventually imprisoned him for obscenity and left him to die in prison.
So, because Napoleon was in a sense a product of the Enlightenment, and I think it was actually Napoleon who eventually sentenced him in the end.
Yes. Napoleon saw Sade as a threat to public order and sentenced him to basically live out his life in prison.
And you also reviewed, well, his other book, there's a book by Bowden called Sade, and this book came after Mad.
Yes, pretty much, and there are stylistic similarities between the two, but on an objective, say, prose level, I'd say Sade is the better book because it doesn't have as many neologisms and is generally it's a bit more academic. The first half book is about sort of, in many ways, it's a retelling of Saad's life, in a sort of, first person aggressive narrative style. Like, it's not very footnoted or well researched. Bowden's, emphasis is trying to basically sort of rub Saad's depravity in, the face of the reader. Like, for example, a quote, from, Bowden, basically, "Already the specter of his own lust was beginning to overtake him, and he desired stronger pleasures than those the brothels provided. He sought out lips which were moist in the light, and he masturbated in the mouths of prostitutes. He drenched blonde hair with water and semen, and his wet penis made mascara run. He began to submerge himself in mania. He had to submerge himself in flesh, and he ripped petticoats and bodices just to get at the flesh." Basically, with, Saad, this book Saad, Bowden was trying to basically take, the existence of Saad, his, degeneracy, or, his personality, and present it in a way that the, modern reader would understand, you know, without the sanitization provided by, the continentalist philosophers or the American philosophers who dismissed Saad entirely.
And Bowden, people have read the book, they said Bowden sounds kind of like a teenager where he's like, "Look at me, I said cunt, look at me, I said cock."
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of that in this book, because again, this is a book that was written not long after Mad, and, Bowden was still in that sort of, you know, teenage rebellious stage, but, it has a certain musicality to it. It sort of, it works, especially when considering that we're talking about a guy like Saad, who was, obsessed with sex to the point of being just outright psychotic.
And, back to the Saad book, but is there anything else on the Mad book that you want to comment on that you didn't get to?
I think we pretty much got all of it. I mean, Mad is a very difficult work to take seriously. As I said, it comes a bit whiny and self-important, but the thing to say about Mad is that, if you read it, like, if you don't take it too seriously and you take it as a sort of, a performance art, it's a very enjoyable book. But if you're older than 18, you're probably not get much out of it politically.
And who are the other historical figures that visited him? I know one was Hobbes.
Yes, Hobbes. Hobbes is one of them, and as to God, sorry, I forgot another one. I didn't consider that to be a really important part of the book, because Bowden does discuss them somewhat, but it's not an academic work. He sort of uses them as anchors for his own feelings and beliefs, so, the specific historical figures are as important as the greater narrative that Mad submerges the reader in.
So you would say that Saad was the most significant?
Yes, I'd say by far the most significant of those figures. Because as I said before, Saad represents, to Bowden, Saad represents the negative side of the Enlightenment. The result of what happens when you try to, again, strip traditional religion, traditional God, and allegiance to the crown out of the peasantry, you end up with chaos, because rationality, to a certain extent, is something that most can't understand. I mean, Bowden's belief is that the Enlightenment, and more modern continentalist philosophers responding to, were projecting their intelligence and their world onto people at large. And what he was arguing to a certain extent was that, you know, the average human being, the average moron or average person, is more or less, is not that far removed from an animal. They're guided more by instinct and by impulses than they are by rationality. So, if you strip traditional morality from them, they're not going to become enlightened intellectuals, you know, discussing the finer point of theism and retweeting Neil deGrasse Tyson quotes. They're going to end up becoming complete, which, you can argue that it's a bit too Hobbesian, but when you watch how society is degenerating now that we're being less religious, we're less conservative, less traditional, and you see how society is degenerating, you can't help but feel that Bowden had a point.
So it is back to the theme of Andy Noe's work, where about what defining sexual morals does to society.
Oh, yeah, basically, yes. Bowden confronts more directly. He actually feminism in Saad. Particularly, he comes from much of his ire on Andrea Dworkin, who is best known as, she's the first to claim that all sex is, and
he even labels her as a...
Yes, pretty much, that she is, she has no morals, and she is more concerned with, destroying traditional morality, or even the left, and replacing it with her own warped, She desires to do to men what Saad did to women. Humiliate them, strip them of their dignity, and use them as tools for her own self-gratification.
And how does she want to do that?
She,
for sex or not for sex?
Through the denial of sexual impulses as being being rape and being therefore out bounds of normal normal interaction is basically doing to men in many ways. What Saad did to women. It's about reducing men to objects in women's narcissistic fantasies. It's about pruning men to serve women's needs and only women's needs.
So would you say there's similarities between Dworkin and do you know the part of Elliot Rodger's manifesto where he creates a world without sex? Are there parallels to that?
Something I very much. Rodger obviously interpreted things differently, but basically the viewpoint of the Marquis de Sade, the viewpoint of Andrea Dworkin is that in many ways they felt sort of oppressed by the other sex. The Marquis de Sade felt oppressed by a traditional morality that kept him from getting the sexual experiences that he wanted. Andrea Dworkin felt oppressed by the patriarchy and patriarchal society that she believed was holding her down as a woman. Elliot Rodger felt oppressed by women in that they were denying him the sex, the sexual intercourse that he wanted. So they all acted out in their sort of radical way to obtain what they wanted, or obtain, deny other people from getting what they wanted but could not have.
And let's see. So you make that pair between the three of those individuals then.
Yes, pretty much. Parallel, but they lie from a... Basically, the root of their psychosis and their beliefs is rejection from the other sex and a feeling of helplessness in the face of the other sex. And if the other sex was denying them something that they...
She was ill for protesting.
Yes, pretty much. She, her life, she had a very sort of... skewered relationship with sex. Later in her life, when she became a radical feminist, she's the one who, I don't know if she coined the concept of political lesbianism, but she popularized it at the very least. Basically, the idea that if a woman is going to be a feminist and is serious about the liberation of being with men, sexually, response to second wave feminism such as who, despite talking about women's rights and women's liberty, were, hooking up men and marrying them. I think it was Henry Kissinger at one point, and she ended up marrying a millionaire. Dworkin saw this as a sort of betrayal of the cause. Early experience helped inform her later radical feminism.
Anything else you would like to add, Marquis de Sade?
Honestly, I'm not as de Sade as I should be, but... I've read 120 Days of Sodom, that's pretty much it.
Have you seen the Pelini film based on it?
I have not. No, I haven't. I'd say Bowden, despite the flaws of his, gets a lot closer to understanding the Sade than most of the traditional scholars. Because, despite being kind of a young punk, Bowden understands Sade was basically pure id. Bowden was, motivated by basically pulses. He was a man stripped of nationality and of all traditional. And again, as I wrote in my review, the Enlightenment, the negative side of the Enlightenment, the part did not envision happening.
Have you read Camille Paglia?
Could you give me a refresher?
I haven't read it, but I'm reading an article about. But I haven't read that.
Oh, I see. Well, I'm familiar with the fact that she's, made her career as a dissident feminist. I'm assuming that her perspective on for reasonable is probably not too far off of Bowden.
And someone, she describes herself as a feminist, but then she ends that counter-feminism.
One of the notable things about her is I think she's... she's a homosexual woman, but she's not a lesbian in the traditional sort of sense. She actually has a sort of, my friend W.F. Price over at the Spearhead once wrote about the subject, and he says, so much as a sexual impulse, an attraction to other women, but which is why you get bed death and the fact that lesbians tend to be very, very undersexed compared to, say, who are all radically oversexed. And Price's argument was that Camille Paley is a rare example of an actual gay woman who actually does have normal sexual impulses that are redirected in that she's obviously not a heterosexual. And this is very critical of the lesbian influence direction that feminism has taken in the past 30 years.
So before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add on any of these topics?
Think of. I think we covered pretty much everything.
Well, Matt Forney, I'd like to thank you for being on.
For inviting me on again.
That's all we have.
Hopefully we can do it again
next time.